Welcome, welcome. This is the monthly Zoom meeting of the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws. We're a nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting the Constitution by restoring the rights of people on the registry and members of their family. As a reminder for some people, maybe it's new information for others, but I just want you to know that. My name is Janice Bellucci. I am the founder of the organization. I'm the current executive director of the organization, and I'm also an attorney. So some people would say I have a very checkered path. But regardless, the fact is that the Alliance is in fact here for people who, for people on the registry as well as members of their family. And we just want you to know that we are here to provide you with two things importantly. Number one is hope, and number two is support. So we've been in existence now for about 15 years. We've gotten a lot of accomplished during the 15 years, and we unfortunately have a lot more to accomplish in the future. But for one thing, I am a very stubborn person, and so I'm not going to let the turkeys get away with the things that they're doing. My apologies to turkeys for saying that, but the fact is, we know that what's happened and what has happened and what is happening now is not reasonable, and quite frankly, it's not constitutional either. So we'll be talking about some of those in just a few minutes here. But before we start talking legal talk, why don't I go ahead and introduce Marty, wherever Marty just went, because Marty has an important message about another service that we provide. There you are. Another service that we provide. I mean, today's meeting and these monthly Zoom meetings are really all about the law, regulations, and related things. But there's other type of help that we provide people who are on the registry, and again, their loved ones as well, and that is emotional support. So, Marty, perhaps you can take it from there.
Thank you, Janice, of course. So, good morning, everybody. We all know the traumatic effects of the registry on ourselves and our loved ones. Bullying, isolation, loneliness, loss of family and friends. There's difficulty securing work and housing. Life can certainly be difficult for everyone affected. That's why Axol runs emotional support groups meetings every week. Our next meetings will be on Thursday and 1 week from today. And yes, not just for registrants. Our loved ones and supporters are more than welcome to attend too. Every Thursday evening, Axol board member Sherry Moreno, she runs the group beginning at 6:30 Pacific time, 9:30 Eastern, that's in the evening. The second and fourth Saturday of each month, licensed therapist and Axol board member Alex Gittinger leads the Saturday afternoon Zoom meetings. The time, 3 o'clock in the afternoon Pacific time, 6 o'clock Eastern. At every meeting, we have a friendly community supporting each other. There's no cost, and we vet every participant so we don't have trolls, bullies, law enforcement, or any haters. So, how can you get access to participate in these wonderful support groups? It's actually very easy. Please see the information that I will post in the chat moments after I finish this announcement. If you don't have access to the chat, you can always click the emotional support group link on the Axol website homepage and follow the directions there. And I promise, after participating in the Axol emotional support groups, you will feel a lot better about yourself. And I'd just like to add, I'd rather be a registrant at an Axol emotional support group meeting with caring friends than a Thanksgiving turkey. Speaking of which, would someone please pass the stuffing and mashed potatoes? Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. Back to
Same
you.
to you.
Thank you, Marty. See, not only is Marty informative, he's also entertaining.
I try.
Thank you, Marty. I don't think I've said yet what the date is, so maybe I should tell people the date. This is going to be recorded, by the way, right? So this is November 15th. In a minute, I will actually, Roger, would you be so kind as to look up the next date, the date for our next Zoom meeting? I know it's in December. We do this every month on the third Saturday of the month, third Saturday of the month. Okay. But what Marty was talking about too, there's emotional support group meetings that are virtual like this that are the second and fourth Saturdays of the month. And then Sherry Moreno is also doing weekly emotional support group meetings. Marty, are her any of her meetings virtual, or do you have to be there in person? Do you know? Marty, you need to unmute yourself, please.
Sorry about that.
Okay.
Believe it or not, I'm only exclusively involved with Alex's group, so
Okay.
I don't know the answer to that. I mean, I would assume it's, I'm assuming it's virtual.
Okay. Well, if anybody has in fact attended any of Sherry's meetings, I have, but it was a long time ago. Now somebody wrote something, and I'm going to read this. Somebody says, by participating in the emotional support group, will I be violating the special condition of parole that says I'm not to associate with anyone known to be a sex offender? It's possible. It is possible. So please check with your parole officer about that. We don't want you to get in trouble. It's not worth being violated.
If you want to talk to your parole officer, my personal recommendation would be to say, look, I'm trying to find all options to rehabilitate myself, to redeem myself, to be a better person. And, obviously that's what you want too. And I found an emotional support group for people on the registry. So yes, there's other registrants in it, but we're talking about moving forward and having progressive lives. So please, if you could give me the okay to just participate in this, it's via Zoom. And I promise there's no harm, there's no problems. We're gonna, it's gonna be something very positive.
Yeah,
Yeah,
I
in the
think it would
worst case
be.
scenario, we do record our meetings in the worst case scenario.
Yeah, thank you, Roger, for that reminder too. So, people, if you can't indeed participate in the live meetings, you can in fact listen to the recorded meetings. And I can't imagine any parole officer would have a problem with you listening to a recorded meeting, but what do I know? I'm not a parole officer. Okay, so folks, one of the things Marty mentioned Thanksgiving in the context of he's glad he's not a turkey. So Marty, I'm just gonna think that that is what you're grateful for, but maybe not. Maybe there's something other thing that you're grateful for in addition to that. And we did this last year and I thought it was really meaningful. So I'm gonna ask people again this year. Please share with us one thing that you're grateful for.
I
And
like,
it could,
I'm
who is
sorry.
that?
That's me.
Okay, Marty, go for it.
Okay. I'm actually going to share a couple of things. First of all, granted, I don't have a lot of friends and loved ones, not as many as I used to, but the ones who I have right now are so absolutely amazing. I am so thankful for them every single day for, for giving me the opportunity to be in their lives and sharing, love the way that we all do. I'm also going to say I'm very thankful for organizations like NARSOL, AXSOL, WAR, Florida Action Committee, Restorative Alliance, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot of groups and there's a lot more that are coming forward. I promise you in the future that are there to help us out, to help us progress and move forward. And one of these days, hopefully logic will supersede hysteria. And Janice, of course, thank you so much for, for AXSOL and everything that you do.
You're very welcome, Marty. You're very welcome. How about you, Roger? Do you wanna be next?
Sure. I'm grateful for my family. I know that there are some people whose families have kind of disowned them because of, our offenses. I'm fortunate that my family has not, and that I have a place to live. That's important too. Now, what I've learned is that if I ever feel sorry for myself, instead of comparing myself to people who have it, I think much better, I'm learning to compare myself to people who have it much worse. And that helps me focus on gratitudes rather than unrealistic expectations.
That's a really good point, Roger. JB, I saw your thumbs up. You want to join in?
Yeah, I guess I'm just thankful for I see a large group of people every week and people not giving up on I connected with people incarcerated and people from all types of connected to the registry, and I think it's just important. I see people succeed and you and everybody else involved in the movement. It makes me enthusiastic. Thank you.
Fabulous. You're welcome. Ava, who
I
wants to be
should say
next?
something.
Yes, please.
This is Jay Willie. I'm thankful for a lot of things, but one of the things that I appreciate a lot and thank is Janice Bellucci. Janice was effective at getting me off the registry, and that just has brought so much relief to me, and I hope all you others are able to get off too. And it's been good so far. Only a couple things bother me, which is getting off the registry doesn't mean you can still travel to all states. Even getting your plea to not guilty doesn't mean that. But appreciate my family, and I'm now living within a mile of both my children and all four of my grandchildren, and it's fabulous. So thank you, Janice, for enabling me to do all that.
You're absolutely welcome. Folks, it's really my goal to get as many people off the registry as possible. If you're living here in California, you probably have a 50% chance of being eligible. And you can talk to me later or Ellie Miller, who's our president of our board, who just joined. Welcome, Ellie. Yeah. And so, we're both determined to get as many people off the registry as possible because it's ridiculous. I mean, the registry in and of itself is ridiculous. Study after study has proven that the registry is not effective. It doesn't stop sexual abuse. If it did, I swear I'd be on the street corner preaching with my soapbox about we need a stronger registry, we need a bigger registry. But instead, I'm doing just the opposite. So, anyway, I appreciate that positive feedback, Ellie. We're talking to, whoops, we're giving thanks right now. Would you like to? Is there anything you're thankful for this year?
I'm thankful for getting us to Sacramento on Lobby Day so that the legislature can hear our voices. And I think as a group, we're pretty powerful. So I'm thankful for that.
Okay. Thank you, Ellie. I was expecting Ellie to mention some of her pets. You can mention pets too, Ellie.
You may see them on the screen as the screen progresses. So they're thankful for me being here with them.
Yeah. I've closed the door to my office so my cats don't come in. Cats, for some reason, like to, I think they're attracted to the stage or something. Yeah. Okay. All right. So is there anybody else that would like to express gratitude for something?
Yeah.
Put your hand up. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, I would. This week, I received an award letter. I'm a public accountant, a member of the American Institute of CPAs. And I'm running into a hard time unemployment wise, and so is my partner. My partner has like applied for 400 different jobs. But this week, I applied to their benevolence fund, and this week they gave me a very nice award. I don't have to worry about moving back with parents or moving back with their parents for a while. So I am happy. Yeah, I'm thankful for that.
Jose, are either you or your partner on the registry?
My partner is.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm very happy for you. Congratulations.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And oh, there's Dave. Okay, Dave, go ahead and unmute yourself. Dave, we can't hear you.
Okay, there we go. Got it. Yeah. Never done it on the phone before. Okay. Yes, I am thankful for everybody. Obviously, you and Ellie and our San Luis Obispo attorney, but everybody on here, and then my ASU buddy just left, Marty and Roger. But 43 years on the registry, I'm finally off. So we're doing the right thing, Jess. If it wasn't for you, I'd be in a corner somewhere huddled up, scared to death, shaking until I die.
Well, you're welcome.
We had no rights. Nothing. We couldn't go to near park. We'd be pushed out of our communities. We can't be near schools. It just goes on and on and on. It wasn't for you. Started with Halloween signs. We wouldn't be here today. And a lot of these new people have no clue what you've done. They're back to 2014.
Yeah, I think a lot of people who are here today do know what not just I have accomplished, but what we have accomplished as an organization.
Together.
It does take a team. And by the way, we do have several board members on the call today. So Ellie is president of the board, as I mentioned. Roger's a board member of AXOL, and we also have a member of the foundation board, Monique or Mona, is here as well. So another person just written, I'm grateful for my wife fighting two breast cancer surgeries and being strong the past 16 months. Grateful for my two adult daughters and our four grandchildren. My family have been my biggest supporters. Also grateful for Janice and her organization, I guess that's AXOL, for the support, care, and guidance along with your voice for standing up for us. Thank you. You're very welcome. It really it does come from my heart doing the work that I do, and every once in a while I do feel overwhelmed. It just seems like the nonsense keeps churning out, and so, or maybe it's like a game of whack-a-mole. I do like to play the game of whack-a-mole, by the way. First with my children, now I just play it shamelessly on my own, and my grandchildren are almost old enough now to play whack-a-mole. Looking forward to playing whack-a-mole with them. Helps to keep things light, folks. Okay, anybody else want to share what they're thankful for today? You can raise your hand. There you go. Christopher?
Yeah, I'm grateful that my health problems haven't killed me yet, and that I'm still here to help protect my son, and to be a pain in the rear ends of people that want to pass bills that more harm than...
Excellent. Thank you, Christopher. Eric, you have your hand up?
Yeah, I want to say how grateful I am for, after 31 years of incarceration, being in my second year of parole with one more to go, and having the changes that have been made while I was incarcerated by you and others, the zoning restrictions, the things that made it difficult for people getting back into society, successfully reintegrating. So I'm very appreciative of the work you and others like you have done, Janice. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Bill wrote, I am grateful for family, Janice, and COSA. For those who are you who are in San Diego, you might already know about COSA, but just in case you don't, let's see, Circles for Accountability and something. But it's a really great program. I know that they're very strong in San Diego. And in fact, they came and joined our meeting last month. Oops, sorry. It was this month, on November 1 in San Diego. And we very happily allowed them to speak at the meeting and stuff and talk about some of the work that they're doing there. But yes, Michael S., got your hand up?
Yeah, this may sound, I have much to be thankful for, but this might sound very counterintuitive, but I am grateful to have a very decent, humane parole agent who has permitted me wide latitude. Just got back from southern Indiana on another trip. I'm going to take a train out to Washington State for Christmas with two of my kids. I'm able to spend a lot of time with Arlene up here in St. Paul. It's nice to have an agent who's responsible for me legally, but also willing to be human and three-dimensional, not just a wonk enforcing rules. Thankful for that.
Oh, that's a great, you're so very lucky, Michael, because I know not how the parole and probation officers are that way. But it sounds like not only that, also this person is respects you and your situation, right?
Yeah, and of course I'm doing my half. I'm absolutely in compliance, and I'm on, you know, you have the good list and the naughty list. And I'm one of the people they don't have to worry about it. And after 2.5 years, they know it. Nice.
Great. Thanks for sharing with us, Michael.
Yeah.
Folks, Roger was kind enough to put in the chat room, but in case you don't see the chat room, the next meeting is on December 20th. So today is November 15th, and the next meeting's on December 20th, right before Christmas, isn't it? Right before Christmas. Okay. So normally what I talk about is, okay, thank you, Monique. Monique just wrote, I can't unmute myself. I'm grateful for you, Janice, and the Bold Person and Fighter. You are, the group is just awesome. She, by the way, is a member of our foundation board of directors. Anthony, I'm thankful for my family and friends. I'm thankful to have a job for the past 7 years. That is good news. Great. And I'm thankful for Janice and the rest of the folks at Axol. Again, you're very welcome. Jose says, thanks for being... maybe there's a typo or two there. I can't read it. Sorry. Okay. So guys and gals, thank you very much for that. I'm an optimist by nature. And I think that from the work that I do, I have to be an optimist. I have to believe that, in fact, we will be able to change things. And every once in a while, I have to admit that my crystal ball is a little fuzzy. In other words, I don't know when certain things are going to happen. And so what I'm specifically referring to right now has to deal with changes to the tiered registry law here in California. I mean, there's a lot. It's helping quite a few people, but it's not helping enough. And so that's why we keep working toward the changes, the improvements, I call them, to the tiered registry law. And I truly believe that they're going to happen, but I can't predict what year it's going to happen. And that feels a little frustrating from time to time, especially when Ellie and Roger and others, you know, we go to Sacramento every year and we talk to the legislators. Sometimes they agree with us completely and they tell us, yes, I agree with you. And then we ask the next question, which is, well, will you be the author of our bill? And the answer is no. So anyway, you know what? It's what we have to deal with. We have to deal with the reality of their situation, the fact that they're afraid that if in fact they become the author of a bill, that indeed they won't get reelected. And, you know, we can bring up Senator Wiener from San Francisco. So he was the author of the tiered registry bill. He got it across the finish line. It wasn't exactly the bill that we wanted, but it was an improvement as to the past. But we've gone to Senator Wiener since then, and basically, he said, no, I've done enough as much as I'm willing to do. And he's concerned about his political future. So in case you haven't heard, Senator Wiener now has announced that he's running for the position, the congressional seat being vacated by Nancy Pelosi. So they're both up in the San Francisco Bay Area. They know each other quite well. And so, you know, it's understandable. I don't like it, but it's understandable. So we keep looking. And if any of you all have some ideas about an author for this improvements bill, that would be fantastic. We'll talk about the specific changes that we're proposing. And by the way, the Sex Offender Management Board now agrees with us on most of the things that we've been advocating for the past 3 years. Okay, so that's what's going on here in California. Somebody says, Senator Scott Wiener is a non-mythical LGBTQ savior and now running for U.S. Congress. We support for a San Francisco seat in Washington, D.C. And I agree with him completely. I agree with that comment completely. He helped us do something that so many people said no to. He took a real risk. He was only in his first term as a senator when he became the author of our bill. Okay, so Christopher's asked, did you get my email about a reply I got from a Florida legislator on HB 45, which is increases these house limits to 1,000 feet and it being rushed through the process? Christopher, if you're here, is that, I think that's you. Why don't you go ahead and speak to this and let folks know this is something that's happening in real time in the Florida legislature. Christopher?
I got an email from Axel on House Bill 45 and Senate Bill 12 and asking people to write to the legislators or call them or whatnot. And the bills are to increase the housing limits to 1,000 feet. I sent out an email to almost 100 of the reps, the senators, and administrative people, sharing a personal story involving my son and myself on the registry. And then I got a reply from one of the legislators letting me know that House Bill 45 is being rushed through the process, going to be going into the Judiciary Committee, and from all indications, that's going to pass out of there rather quickly as well.
Okay, so maybe a little background information would be helpful. So what Christopher's talking about is a bill that's pending in the state legislature, or in the Florida state legislature. So what this bill says is that nobody on the registry can live within 1,000 feet of bodies of water, public bodies of water, something like that. So you don't have to worry about backyard swimming pools, but anything, if there's a municipal pool, of course, the beaches, the ocean there, the bay, the rivers and stuff. I mean, there's a lot of water in Florida. And so I know I participated in one meeting this past week with a lobbyist who's trying to help stop this bill. And there was, I mean, I think it was like about 80% of the state was going to be off limits if in fact this bill gets passed. So this is a kind of nonsense, and I'm being kind. It's early in the day. I try to keep my swearing to the afternoon and evening. So I'll just call it nonsense for now. But this is one of the things that they're attempting to pass in the legislature. Roger has in fact put here in the chat room a link to the article that we have posted on our website, but also the things you can do like Christopher did. And Christopher, do you live in California or in Florida or somewhere else?
I'm in the great state of Missouri.
Missouri, very good. Okay, so I guess the lesson there is you don't have to be from Florida to weigh in on Florida legislation. So I have been talking to the Florida Action Committee about what's going on. And I have said, indeed, if they wish to sue the stuffing out of this Florida legislature, I'd be happy to serve in that capacity. So I've been talking to Florida for a while about filing a lawsuit there. And anyway, we were talking about another one first, but then this bill came up. It's, you know, it's, I'd say, unconstitutional. There's all kinds of due process problems here. There's also, you know, Fourth Amendment, Tenth Amendment. I mean, it's just, you know, I can just keep rattling off these reasons that this legislation would be unconstitutional and wondering why in the heck they would pass it. And because they've, you know, there've got to be some smart people in Florida. I'm just going to give them the benefit of the doubt. They need to go find them, and then they need to be educated as to why they shouldn't do such a ridiculous thing. But we'll wait and see what happens. Sometimes, by the way, legislatures pass laws knowing full well that they're unconstitutional and knowing full well that they'll be challenged in court because of that makes them look, they think it makes them look good. You know, if I'm tough on crime, if I look like I'm an enemy of people on the registry, then people are going to want to reelect me. So I don't believe that as well. I don't believe that, but that's some people do. Okay. Mariah, do you want to say what you just said? Do you want to speak to that, or do you want me to read it for you? I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly.
Yes, you did pronounce my name correctly. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Yeah. I can just say, I guess what I wrote in the chat, I said I'm a victim of rape living in Minnesota. I'm just kind of jumping into this cause and realizing how horrible the registry is, and I'm very much against it. And I hope that my voice will be valuable in reform of it.
Absolutely. I'm so glad that you joined us today. Can I just ask a really direct question? You don't have to answer if you don't want to. But I mean, do you think that as a victim of sexual abuse, do you feel like the registry or these laws are make you feel any better or make you feel any safer?
No, in fact, the opposite. I think it makes me feel less safe. I think these laws definitely harm our community as a whole. I really don't like them.
Wow. I hope you'll connect with me outside this meeting. Roger, please put my Excel, put my AOL email address, would you, in the chat, as well as my phone number. And Mariah, I hope that you will contact me because we need to talk to you. You can be a very valuable voice in this process.
Absolutely. I would love that.
Fabulous. Thank you so much. Wow. Okay. I'm thankful for Mariah this morning. Wow. This is amazing. Thank you. Okay. So folks, we have a variety of topics to talk about. One of the things I'm going to bring up, and I'm not sure I'm going to bring up them up in any certain order, but somebody reached out to me this past week. Thank you, Roger, for putting that information in the chat. Reached out to me about having his passport added to his cell phone. I don't know if I really believed him. But now I got an article about it, so it must be true, right? No, but anyway, and then he was saying that this is a good thing because then the unique identifier can't be added to on your phone, your passport on the phone. He said that he has one, and the unique identifier is not visible on his passport that's on the phone. But I just don't know about this. I have to admit, I have really strong feelings about this, which is there's no way in hell I'm putting my passport on my phone. So let me just put it out there. But maybe some people think it's a good thing. And then, you know, if in fact the unique identifier is not added to it, I don't know, does that make it better? Is anybody on the meeting today, has anybody done this? And I understand it might just be possible by if you have an iPhone that this is possible. I don't know then if Android phones can do the same thing, but I just worry about I'm scrolling on my phone here. I shouldn't be doing this. Roger, do you think you can look that up during this meeting and see if you can find an article about it? I meant to like print it out or something like that, but yeah. Sorry, I should not look at the chat room so much. So anyway, that's really curious. If indeed that a passport can be downloaded on a phone, anybody's phone, and I'll just say, okay, if you're willing to take the risk of having your passport on your phone, okay, then what does it look like, and is it going to include the unique identifier or not? The article that I saw, I thought was only going to be in the beginning here, is only going to be valuable within the United States. Even though it's your passport. So I don't know what's going on here. I really don't. Again, this is really breaking news to me. But you would have to make your own decision again, whether or not you would like your passport to be on your phone. I'm a member of the Sacramento Zoo. I'm willing to put that on my phone, but I'm not willing to put my passport on the phone. And that just seems that information is just too personal and could cause harm. I mean, then person could identify themselves as you. I don't know. I'm not usually a paranoid person at all, but that just seems too far for me. Okay, Roger just put it here. iPhone users can now add their passport to their Apple Wallet, and here's how to do it. Okay. Somebody says, I took a pic on my phone of my passport for the official to confirm my identity for the ID me process. So that's from G Cornish. G Cornish, is that the same as putting your passport on your phone?
No.
No? Okay, can you explain that then, please? What is it like?
You're talking about being uncomfortable at having the passport on the phone. Mine is on my phone now because when I was applying for the ID3 for the video process, that was one of the items I could produce for him to prove my identity. The picture of it does not accord indicate the, and I don't think they really cared about any identity marker at all. It was just for identification. But it's on my phone, so I'm going to erase it now after all this talking.
Okay. All right. I don't mean to spook anybody, but that's just the way. And as Roger knows, because he's my IT guru, I'm very old-fashioned. Even with all of my passwords, they're not anywhere on any computer. I just refuse to do that, and I'm very old-fashioned. By the way, I have an AOL account, so I'll just put things in perspective for you. So all my passwords are written down on pieces of paper in a file, a paper file. So I guess if my house burns down, I'm going to be in trouble. But other than that, I'd much rather that be on these pieces of paper under lock and key than be on some electronic thing that I just think you lose control of it. Okay. Roger also put U.S. Customs regulations for mobile passport control. Okay. So I'm letting you know that something new is happening and you can investigate for yourself. Roger has provided two very helpful links here for us all to use so we can explore whether or not we think it's a good idea. I have security concerns about it, but you might have a different opinion. I also, I have an AOL account. So that explains a lot. Okay, so so let's talk about international travel. It's something that people are almost always interested in. And, you know, the holidays are coming up. We've got Thanksgiving coming up in, what, about a week? And then beyond that, of course, Christmas and Hanukkah and a lot of different holidays, Kwanzaa and the like. And so this is a time when many people do travel, including overseas. Nothing has really changed about overseas travel at this point in time, but there is a lot of uncertainty. So though there's more uncertainty, believe it or not, in domestic travel. But let's talk about overseas first. All right, so this is the thing. There's a federal law called the International Megan's Law. And if you were convicted of a sex offense involving a minor, and that is somebody under the age of 18, because that's the federal law, you're required to register in any state, even a state like Florida, where it's passive. Like, you went there one time, you registered there one time, you haven't been there 20 years. It's still, the fact is, you're on the Florida registry. Then you have to have a unique identifier added to your passport at some point in time. I filed a lawsuit about this. It was a big lawsuit, and I was really hopping mad about it. And I still believe that the unique identifier is equivalent to a scarlet letter, or how about this, the red J that Nazi Germany put on the passports of Jews back in the day. So, but that is something that is supposed to happen either when you apply for a new passport or you're renewing your passport. And it says in the law that the State Department must add the unique identifier if you qualify. Oh, thank you. There's the turkey card. if in fact you do qualify. and then the question is, well, what difference does it make? I'm not absolutely sure what difference it makes. I've heard many people go to these 29 countries in Europe called the Schengen nations. And in those 29 countries, they'll let you come and visit regardless of whether or not you have that unique identifier. And in case you don't know what it says, and I'm paraphrasing here, it says this person has been convicted of a sex offense involving a minor. Well, you know what? That's really, to me, vague language. It doesn't say what the age of your victim was. It doesn't say how many years ago you were convicted. It doesn't say any other thing that might be useful to a country. So what happens many times is the countries that look at this unique identifier, they're basically, they're interpreting that language, you know, through their own perspective. And so there are countries out there, I've been told, where the age of consent is 12. Okay, so if it says you've been convicted of a sex offense involving a minor, they probably think that, you know, you sexually abused a six-year-old, which probably is not true. You know, your victim might have been 25. So this is the type of thing, well, I'm sorry, not 25, but 17. Okay, so this is one reason that this unique identifier is so bad, because, again, other countries are, in fact, interpreting it, though, according, or, you know, with the perspective or the lens of their own laws. So, and to make matters worse, so when I filed the lawsuit, the unique identifier was like on page 25 of the passport, something called the endorsement pages. I didn't even know, I've had a passport for decades, but I didn't even know these enforcement pages existed. I'd really never looked at them before. But guess what? I looked at the endorsement pages after that happened. But unfortunately, they've been moved up from the endorsement pages, which is toward the back of your passport, all the way to page one of your passport. Page one. Okay, page one is a page before your photograph, in case you're wondering. So you open up the cover, and page one is a page on your left, and page on the right is a page where your photograph is. So this is a very prominent placement in your passport of the unique identifier. So I know many people who say, I don't want to get this unique identifier, I'm not going to do it. And, you know, that is your choice, you know, but the problem is, if you don't have a unique identifier on your passport and you travel overseas, or you try to travel overseas, you could be stuck in your travel. And this actually happened to one gentleman. He and his wife were on a flight from Los Angeles to the Netherlands, and they had boarded the flight. They were sitting in their seats getting ready for the plane to take off, and he got tapped on the shoulder by somebody from the Department of Homeland Security, who basically told him that he needed to get off the plane because his passport had been revoked. Now, according to my client, that's the first notice he had gotten that, in fact, his passport had been revoked. And it was the tail end of COVID, and there was no possible way for him to get a new passport with a unique identifier before all this housing that he had paid for before. It was a very expensive lesson for him. So again, folks, it's up to you to decide how much uncertainty you're comfortable living with, how big a risk you're willing to take. My recommendation these days, if indeed you want to travel overseas, again, and your offense involved a minor, and you're required to register in at least one state, go ahead and get a new passport with the unique identifier added. So the craziness about this, and I do think this is crazy, is you're going to have to request that the unique identifier be added to your passport. It's not even something on the form itself, the passport application. You have to write a letter that goes with the application that says, I am a covered sex offender, and I want you to add this unique identifier to my passport. Again, you all have to weigh the pros and the cons of this, whether or not what you're going to do. I know some people who are eligible to petition for removal have told me they've decided to wait until they get their off the registry. And that's an understandable answer as well, but it's up to you. So let's talk about these 29 countries. I want you all to know that you do have, or you are able to travel to at least 29 countries in Europe. The four large Schengen nations are Italy, Spain, France, and Germany. I like to laugh and say, because I'm Italian, half 50% Italian, just say that, oh yeah, and they'll meet you at the border with a bottle of red wine and some pasta. I can't promise that, but what I can promise is they will let you enter. You will be able to visit Italy, okay? And then there's 28 other countries that will allow you to come visit, even if you have that unique identifier added to your passport. So, okay, Roger, even here's a link. Roger, you're so good at this. He just put the link up for a sample letter here, and this information too is on our website, obviously. And so, but if you want to, you can contact me separately. If you have indeed gotten a passport without the unique identifier and you qualify for the unique identifier, there is a phone number that you can call, and supposedly you can call them and they will give you a new passport at no cost. So as far as other countries in the world or other areas of the world, Asia is more or less off limits. I have heard recently that some people have gotten to visit Hong Kong. They've gotten in, you know, been able to visit Hong Kong, but other countries in Asia, don't bother. I'm serious, folks, because what's going to happen is you're going to spend your time and your money getting there only to be kept in the airport and turned around at the airport. So a real life story of one of my clients, he has a wife, and she is in fact a citizen of Japan, and they were traveling to Japan to buy a second home. They have a home here in California, and they wanted to buy a home in Japan. And the fact is that when they got to Tokyo, they would not let him out of the airport. And so guess what? They didn't buy the home in Japan. Because of course it would make no sense because he couldn't even visit that house. So please beware. I don't say these things lightly. Again, I want you to save the time, money, and possibly the embarrassment too. Like I know in one situation, a man whose wife is in the Philippines and whose wife is Filipino, and they went to the Philippines and it was going to be a big deal. And there was a big graduation or wedding. I'm not even remembering correctly anymore. But anyway, they had a big celebration to go to. And, he could not get out of the airport. And that's it. They're not going to let you out of the airport. So, and by the way, they're not going to let you make any phone calls. They're not going to do anything. So those people who are waiting for you are going to be wondering where the heck you are, right? And so at least for a while, you'll be held really as a captive. I call it false imprisonment myself, but we haven't filed any lawsuits yet about that. But the fact is, don't waste your time and don't waste your money going to Asia. And maybe Hong Kong is available and maybe it's not. Okay, South America, you know, I don't know the current state of affairs in South America. I really don't. There used to be a person who was collecting this information for us. And unfortunately, that person is back in prison, federal prison. So unfortunately, he didn't learn his lesson from being convicted once for the possession of child pornography. And he's back in prison a second time for the same thing. So please don't do that. Please learn how terrible it is, how many challenges are before you being on the registry. Don't repeat it. It's only going to get worse. It will only get worse. Okay. So anyway, does anybody have any specific questions, I guess, about traveling overseas? I've mentioned the unique identifier. I've mentioned the Schengen nations. There is something that's supposed to be coming up next year. It's the acronym is ETIAS. And Roger, maybe you can put this in the chat about what that stands for. It's an acronym. And so things are going to supposedly are going to change next year in visiting those 29 countries, even that you'll have to get not a visa, but something called a permit. And supposedly the permit is something that is going to be electronically added to your passport, which is both fascinating and terrifying at the same time. What do you mean you're going to add something to my passport electronically? How do you have access to my passport electronically? Michael, you have your question up or hand up, rather?
I keep never hearing about it, whether or not Scandinavia, specifically Norway and Sweden and Finland, are included in these Schengen countries.
Maybe Roger can look that up while we're meeting. It's not, I know the list is on our website. I don't want to go to the list myself because I might I might cancel this meeting for everybody. So Roger can look that up. I think that they are. I know the Netherlands is. So again, that couple that got turned away, and the man told while he's sitting on the airplane that his passport had been revoked. I know they were going to go to the Netherlands.
Yeah, no, I'm thinking about Norway. Thank you.
Okay, surely. Okay, so Roger, just look at the list if you would. Well, I'll click on it, I guess. There we go. Yes, Norway is one of the nations. Did you want, and Finland is one of the nations. Sweden is a nation and one of the nations. So is Switzerland. Does that answer your question? Okay. Michael, did that answer your question? There you go.
It absolutely did. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Now I need to get off supervision so I can go.
Excellent. There you go. User, you have your hand up.
Yes, good morning, Janice and the group.
Good morning.
I had a question about studying overseas and being in this situation of having to register. Can we be gone for any length of time, or is there a time limit? Like, for instance, I can't visit another state here, even if I'm off parole, for more than, 2 or 3 days or something like that. Are there any kind of time limitations for overseas study?
I think that there are, but I don't know what the limitation is. Okay, I had a family member who, remember, I'm half Italian, right? A sister. She decided she was going to move to Italy. And so she was able to go to Italy for night and stay there for up to 90 days. All right. But she wasn't a student. So I don't know if there's some different provision for students or not. Maybe somebody who's with us today knows that. But wherever the school is or whatever like that, I think that they would have the answer for you.
Okay, thank you.
You're certainly welcome. Yeah, the things that I've been talking about is whether or not you would be allowed to co-visit, but I don't know about the length of the visit. But it's not like, you know, like in the United States, Nevada, the state of Nevada says 48 hours triggers a requirement to register. And oh, by the way, get this, you know, those 29 nations in Europe, they don't even have registries. So you don't have, there's no place to register. And you know, yeah, so there's just no place for you to register.
Can I live there permanently?
Well, you know what? A growing number of people who are in the registry are choosing to do that. Thing, one of the factors you need to think about, though, if indeed you're eligible to petition for removal from the registry, like here in California, the time that you spend overseas does not count toward registration time. And so I did have a case about 3 or 4 months ago. It was a petition case, and the man, he was assigned to Tier 2. He had lived in Mexico with his wife, came back to the United States, and I filed his petition for removal because it had been more than 20 years. But guess what? 10 of those years were in Mexico, I didn't know for sure how a court would come down on this, but sure enough, the judge denied his petition for removal from the registry because he said, you're missing 10 years, basically. Those 10 years that he lived in Mexico didn't count, but it's kind of not crazy. It's not like he went to Mexico basically to drink margaritas on the beach. He went to Mexico to start a business with his family. He did all these wonderful things, you know, was a great member of the community. But the fact is, Mexico doesn't have a registry. It was not even possible for him to register. But anyway, the court did hold it against him. And so he will have to wait another 10 years to go back before he's eligible to petition.
I have another quick question that's somewhat related.
Okay.
Thinking about traveling overseas, and you're saying we should maybe wait to see if our situation changes. I have about a year and 2 months to where I can start to petition. But my question is, when would you recommend, say, for instance, it's February 15th or something of 2027. Do you recommend maybe starting, getting organized and starting to prepare before the 15th or after the 15th, say if it is the 15th?
I'm not sure what you mean by prepare.
To get off the registry, to start the legal process?
No one can petition for removal from the registry until they're eligible. Mentioned a date, February of 2027. So it's not like you can, unfortunately, you can't apply 6 months ahead of time. You have have to wait until you're eligible before you can file your petition, okay? And then the petitioning process, and we'll be talking about the petitioning process in greater length later in this meeting, but the petitioning process takes about up to six months.
Oh, wow. Okay, thank you. You're
welcome. Okay, thank you for those questions. Again, when it comes to overseas travel, whether or not you have to have a unique identifier on your passport, again, if you're convicted of a sex offense involving a minor and you're on even one state's website, you're supposed to have a unique identifier on your passport. Does it make a difference? Again, 29 nations in Europe. Nope, doesn't make a difference. They know how ridiculous the United States of America is in general, but certainly when it comes to the topic of sex and, you know, this whole thing, I'm sure they're laughing at us. So, oh well, that might be just many reasons they're laughing at us right now. But the fact is, you'll be able to enter the country regardless of whether or not you have a unique identifier. I'm not gonna look at the chat or talk about it because it's specific to that question about being a student overseas. Okay, so let's talk about domestic travel. As I said just briefly, it's actually more complicated traveling domestically when you're either on the registry or you've gotten off the registry. And the reason that I'm saying that is because all 50 states have different requirements or triggers for the requirement to register in their state. And the thing is, you need to know what the requirements are, because if you basically don't register when you're supposed to register, the fact is, you could end up being charged with and convicted of failing to register. Now, failing to register is not a sex offense, but it's still an offense. And you could spend up to 5 years in prison or jail for failing to register somewhere. So it's to be avoided if possible. So the thing is, you can do the homework yourself. Please do the homework yourself and or contact me or Ellie or another legal professional to look it up for you. And it really does make a huge, huge difference. Whether or not when you're required to register in another state. I mentioned Nevada. I'll just emphasize Nevada and also the state of Florida. If you're there for more than 48 hours, it triggers a requirement to register. Okay, all of Nevada and also all of Florida. So if you're in either of those states for more than 48 hours, you're required to register. Rafael, you have your hand up, sir?
Yes, thank you. I wondered if I could relate my little experience. I know that it's international travel and it's still, and you're moving into domestic, but I am naturalized American. I was born in Guatemala City from Italian parents. I thought I escaped it all and went to Guatemala to see if I could maybe transfer and live there. And one of the experiences that I had was that once people got to know me and I introduced myself and this and why not, it was pretty customary that they would Google you. So my experience was that, yeah, I'm in a foreign country and I think I'm getting away from all this madness in America, but you're not. So my conclusion was to wait until I get off the registry before I can literally move and travel anywhere, because I'm comfortable here. I know what it's like. I know what my protection is and my situation is, but I'm not aware of any of that in a foreign country. Just wanted to share that.
That's a really good point, Rafael. Thanks for bringing it up. And folks, I know one of the plaintiffs in my lawsuit challenging the international Megan's Law so many years ago, he's a gay man and he's from Iraq, and he basically said if that unique identifier was added to his passport and he tried to travel to Iraq, he would be killed because Iraq kills people who are gay. And I'm not sure why. Anybody have an idea? Maybe somebody else. There you go. Okay. Somebody else needed to turn off their to mute themselves. Okay. So, back to domestic. It's really important if you're going to travel domestically to look ahead as to what the registration requirements are. They're not always easy. Sometimes they become quite difficult to try to figure out, but they need to be figured out because you need to know whether or not you're taking a risk. Now, I know people have called me and said, oh, well, I just spent a week in Las Vegas. Remember, Las Vegas is in Nevada. 48 hours, you're supposed to register. And he said, and nothing happened. I was happy for him. I was really happy for him. But the fact is, something could happen while you're in Las Vegas. You could be in a car accident. You could be a pedestrian walking across the street and be hit by a car. You know, so many things. You can drive by shooting, I guess, on the strip. I mean, all these things that I've read about. You can tell I'm not a fan of Las Vegas. But the fact is that if you end up in the hospital, guess what? They're going to look you up and they're going to find out that you're on the registry. And then they're going to be doing things like looking to see how long, you know, you've been there. And it's like, well, how would they know? Well, they look at your flights. When did you fly in? When is your flight out? You know, even if you have a car, you know, when the hotel, when did you arrive at the hotel? When are you leaving? I mean, these are the kinds of things you have to make this decision yourself about whether or not you're comfortable with staying in a place longer than necessary to register. There are some places, and Hawaii is the most generous state. You can stay, go to Hawaii for up to 10 days without registering. And by the way, you can go to Hawaii for a total of 30 days a calendar year, but 10 days per trip without having to register. Now, why do I tell you about these things? The thing is, if you are required to register in more than one state, the fact is, when it comes to that unique identifier on your passport, right? Remember, if you're required to register in just one state, then in fact, and your conviction involved a minor, then in fact, you could end up with a unique identifier in your on your passport, even though you're no longer required to register in the state where you're convicted. So in California in particular here, you know, where I live and where I practice law, the fact is I can get people off the California registry, but if they have visited Florida or if they visited New York, those two states never take people off the registry, okay? Again, you might have gone to Disney World 20 plus years ago, right? And if you registered then, the fact is then you're still on the registry. And the registry laws in Florida have indeed been challenged. And in fact, there are dead people who are no longer alive on the Florida registry. And the family members of one of those people tried to get him off the registry in Florida. And the court said, nah, they don't have to do that. So please, please, please. That's why we are telling you to be careful when you go visit another state. Now, if you're there's a state that you visit on a regular basis, it really, I would say, is a good idea to consult a legal professional in that state, because then they can interpret the laws for you. And part of this, it, I mean, it gets so complicated as a lawyer, and it many times is a mystery, or maybe it's more like a riddle or a puzzle. Worse than a Rubik's Cube, by the way, is that sometimes the law where you're convicted says you're convicted of X, Y, or Z. Well, in the state that you're going to, there's no such law. You know, there's no law with exactly the same title or the same criminal elements. And so that's why it gets so complicated sometimes about whether or not you're going to trigger a registration requirement in another state. So please, please, please do your homework ahead of time. If you're going to visit a certain location, a certain state multiple times, maybe, you know, your parents live there, your aunt and uncle live there, whoever, are there some natural wonder that you like to go see, like the Grand Canyon, it really is a good idea for you to go ahead and find out from a legal professional whether or not you'd have to register once you stay there. Or, you know, if you can stay there, even Nevada, you can stay there for 46 hours and not have to register, right? But plan accordingly, because otherwise you could end up in some deep trouble here. You know what? One of the things that I forgot to mention when it comes to overseas travel is, in fact, this notification. So if you have to notify your registration office if you're going to travel overseas, and you're supposed to do it at least 21 days ahead of time. I always say to my clients 30 days just to make sure, because sometimes government officials can't count properly. But anyway, whatever amount of time you're comfortable with, you have to tell them that you're going to travel overseas. And guess what? Then they have to take that information and send it to the federal government. And then what the federal government does, this is a U.S. federal government, what they do is then they send it to the country to which you're traveling and saying, hey, we want you to know that somebody convicted of a sex offense involving a minor is coming to visit your country. Now, again, those 29 nations in Europe just laughed. They said, we don't care. But there are other countries like Mexico, by the way, and Canada too, that do care. So you're not going to be able to travel to Canada and Mexico, probably, if you're still required to register, because you still have to give that 21-day notice. Now, when I've been successful in getting people's petitions granted, and I'm up to 137, I believe, at this point in time, people, I also always send a notice to the Department of Homeland Security, letting them know that my client is no longer required to register in California. And this is consistently the reply I get back from DSH, which is, well, that's nice, but we reserve the right to basically look for their names on flight manifests, right, and send a notice to another country. So I don't know if that's actually ever happened before. right? But they say they reserve the right to do that. So so anyway, just please know that this may or may not be happening. And again, those nations in Europe, I guess, how many times can I say, please go visit those nations in Europe, because they're reasonable, they're rational, and they would be happy to have you come visit. Lots of things to see in those countries too, by the way. Thank you, Dave, for the 137 and a lot of exclamation points. Yeah, my new goal is 200. I was surprised how quickly I got to 100 people petitions being granted, and now my new goal is 200. And by the way, well, we'll talk about it in a little bit. Does anybody have any questions at this point in time about domestic travel? Place you're trying to go to or wanting to go to or whatever. Have you been to? Have you had a problem somewhere? Or you've been able to escape trouble? All right, so I shall move on. Let's talk about Section 8 housing. There's some confusion in the federal government about Section 8 housing. There's actually a law, it's really in the form of a regulation, that says if you're on a registry for a lifetime, that you cannot obtain or even live in somebody else's Section 8 housing. For some people, this causes a huge problem. I currently have a client right now who's married, and he can't live with his wife. Initially, he was told he couldn't live with his wife because he's on the registry. But in California, because he's not on the highest tier, and he's no longer a lifetime registrant. And so I wrote a letter to the federal government, and he took it to them, and they said, oh, well, in that case, all right, you are now eligible. So he can, in fact, live with his wife in Section 8 housing. So, but it's also true in other states too. If you're on some tier other than the highest tier, right, lifetime tier, then in fact, you can, in fact, live in Section 8 housing. I wish that all the federal government officials were up to speed about this, but in California, I think they thought, well, because for so long in California, everybody on the registry was, in fact, a lifetime registrant. They're like, oh, well, I don't even have to think about this. If you're from California, you're not eligible. But unfortunately, things have changed. So if you, in fact, are having a problem with Section 8 housing, please go ahead and reach out to me. I'd be happy to help you with your situation. Okay, Roger, would you be so kind? This is a good time for a commercial, an Axol commercial.
Yes, guys, we work real hard for you, and we're super efficient. We take every buck that you guys, you invest in us, and we're doing some amazing stuff, considering we don't have a big staff, don't have a big building and offices and that, and a lot of us just volunteer. The more that you guys donate to us, the more we can do. I mean, that's the bottom line. It takes money for us to send Janice and others places, this website, the Zoom and all that. Again, we spend your money very wisely, but we need more to do more. It's that simple. And you can just go to the website, and on the right side of each page is a donate button. Easy to do. And please consider putting us, I have Axol in my will because I want to know, you know, that could work and continue on using resources. So, you know, talk to your attorney, whoever made your will, and say, hey, let's put some of that in for Axol. We also accept donations. If you guys were lucky enough to invest in the stock market the past few years, you can donate appreciated stock to our Family Safety Foundation and get a tax write-off for the full amount. And again, you can talk to your investment person, your tax person about that. But so many ways to, really fight back on the incredible craziness that's going on. We need the resources to do that. We appreciate all of you. And we especially appreciate all of you who show up to our events, you know, especially in Sacramento, and come to our in-person meetings. We always look forward to seeing you there. So great working for you.
Thank you, Roger. And
can I say something, Janice? I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, go right ahead.
But I don't know how to raise my hand. What is, just curiosity, what is your like annual budget? Or I have no clue.
You know, I think in the past year we spent about $45,000.
Oh boy, that's pretty modest. And so you guys clearly aren't getting paid or paid much.
Yeah. And the fact is, I mean, all of our funds are in fact donated. We've applied for some grants, and even, you know, organizations like ACLU and the Equal Impact Fund, and you know, they say no. We apply for the grants and they say no. And I'll just call it the ick factor. And so many people do not want us just don't want to support us. So we have to turn to the members. I guess we're kind of lucky in one respect in that we have over 100,000 people on the registry in California, and there's only almost 1 million in the United States. And so there's a large number of people out there. And I know Frank Lindsay, who is our treasurer, he used to say, well, if everybody would only give $10, or, you know, if in fact $10, if you have an extra $10, give $20, because there's surely a person out there who can't afford $10. It would be fabulous. So yeah, we do things very frugally, like our office, and I put an address there about an address for AXA. Well, that's a virtual office. So we basically pay about $70 a month so we can receive mail there. And if indeed it's necessary to have a meeting there, we can pay for a meeting room. But we don't pay monthly rent. We do pay for things like postage. We pay for some gas for, you know, some of our board members to drive from place to place. And I know Ellie, Ellie's come to Sacramento so many years in a row, and I know she pays her own airfare. We're a frugal organization. We use every dollar quite wisely. So please donate if you can.
Thank you. And I will.
All right. Thank you. Okay. Somebody just noted that we have a conference coming up. We do. We didn't have a conference this year. There's a variety of reasons for it. Proud Boys was one of the reasons. Proud Boys we've never been on the radar. Thank you, God, for that. But the fact is that another organization, NARSAL, got on the radar and caused the hotel where they were going to have their conference this year and caused the hotel to cancel their conference. So they basically, instead of having their conference in June, they had their conference in late September, and we decided, and we were going to have our conference in October. So we said, you know what, we'll skip this year because letting NARSAL do what they needed to do, and we'll have our conference in 2026. So we are going to have an in-person conference in 2026. Thank God COVID is over. And we're moving it. We're moving it from the law school where we've had the conference in the past to a location near the LAX airport. And we'll let you know the exact dates when we know. Actually, we're waiting for NARSAL to announce when they're going to have their conference in 2026. So it's going to be a wonderful opportunity for folks to get together in person. As great as the virtual conferences are, getting a conference in person is that much better, because there's all these hallway conversations, the networking that goes on, the same, and of course having the same great speakers. So just keep posted, and Roger, maybe you can tell people what to do in order to receive notices from us.
Easy peasy. On the right side of our page, the same location as the donate is getting on our email list, and we'll tell you all the good stuff, important things that are happening, information that is affects you, all kinds of good stuff. So highly recommend sign up for that. No, we don't spam you. We give you information that's very useful.
And when texting,
if you can't get email, you can also ask for texts on there. It shows you how. Sorry.
Yeah, thank you, Roger. So we're very frugal in this regard too. So as Roger just said, we don't spam you. We don't send out notices willy-nilly. We wait till there's something important to announce. But by doing that, you get the information first, right? So I know there's some people who look at the website every single day. Most people don't look at it every single day. But the fact is, if you sign up for these notices, then you will know right away when something significant has happened. So thank you for that, Roger. Okay, so let's talk about the SORNA litigation. So SORNA are federal regulations, Sex Offender Registration and Notification Act, that affect everybody who lives in a SORNA compliant state, and everybody who's been, in fact, convicted by the federal government. So the federal government, it's almost 3 years ago, passed these regulations. They're terrible. They're absolutely terrible. And what's even worse is that the way the federal government is interpreting these regulations is they don't care if you live in a SORNA compliant state or not. They said they apply to you. They apply to anybody who has ever been convicted of a sex offense. Okay. Anybody ever convicted of a sex offense. That is absolutely terrible and should be frightening. So we were ready. Well, we were certainly considering seriously whether or not to file a lawsuit about this when another organization that has is much larger, it's been around much longer, and has considerably more resources than we do, the Pacific Legal Foundation, stepped up and said, hey, we want to file a lawsuit about this. Would you, Axol, be willing to serve as a plaintiff in this case? And we said yes. By the way, the Pacific Legal Foundation is, I mean, they have over 50 attorneys on staff. I'm just so jealous. Over 50 attorneys, right? We have one. That would be me. But I do have an assistant, a legal assistant. And by the way, let me just talk about it just real quickly. My legal assistant is somebody who was a formerly licensed attorney. He is on the sex offender registry. And because he's on the registry, his license was taken away from him. But guess what? They couldn't take away from him. They couldn't take away his knowledge. They couldn't take away his experience. And they couldn't take away his passion to do the work that he's doing. So you have two legal professionals, okay? Even if only one of us is a licensed attorney. So together, he and I work very closely together and do all kinds of remarkable things, including filing lawsuits. So I mentioned the SORNA litigation. This is something, again, funded by Pacific Legal Foundation. In addition to having a staff of 50 plus attorneys, the fact is they've gone to the U.S. Supreme Court at least 17 times. And at those 17 times, they've won 14 of the cases. That's a very good track record. I don't know what is in baseball, maybe if Marty was still here, he could talk about it. So this is a really great record. It's been an interesting case and watching it and being a party in the case instead of the litigator, because we keep waiting for the judge to make a final decision. So we don't have a final decision in the case. And the hearing for oral argument about these cross motions for summary judgment keeps getting moved. So the latest thing is that the judge said there was supposed to be a hearing in this month, earlier this month, and the judge said, nope, we're not going to have the hearing. We're not going to set a new hearing date until the government shutdown has ended. So I think officially the shutdown has ended, but then the two parties have to get together and compare calendars. But who knows? Ellie said quite wisely in the Axol board meeting this week that, chances are the judge will set a hearing date only to change it later anyway. But stay tuned on this. I think one reason that the judge is doing what he's doing is he knows absolutely that no matter how he rules on the case, his decision is going to be not overturned, hopefully, but his decision will be appealed to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal. Okay, so because of Judge Bernal, because of Judge Bernal, we do have in California, we have a preliminary injunction that has been issued, and that means for sure that the SORNA regulations do not apply to registrants in California, and that's good news. However, it would be even better news, of course, if he expanded the injunction and made it nationwide. It's probably not going to happen. And maybe one reason he's not going forward is at least there's an injunction of California. And I say that because there's a U.S. Supreme Court decision, Trump versus CASA, which basically said the Supreme Court does not like injunctions. Right. So listen to us. This is the Supreme Court talking, not me. And the Supreme Court saying, listen to us, district court judges, don't be issuing these injunctions. And certainly don't do what they consider a universal injunction, like an injunction that would apply to the entire United States. So we'll just wait and see what Judge Bernal is going to do next. LED, is there anything you want to add here about the case or about the judge?
No, I don't understand why there's been no decision, but we'll wait out and, see what happens.
What else can we do, right?
Yeah.
And by the way, I actually think Judge Bernal is a good judge. I've appeared before him twice. And he ruled in my favor once and he ruled against me the other time. But even when he did rule against me, he had a good reason for doing it. So I just can't understand why he's doing what he's doing about the delays. But, all we can do is follow what he's doing. And by the way, when there finally is a hearing and it actually happens, anybody who wants to can actually watch it online. You don't have to go to Riverside, California. That's the good news. I live in California and I don't even want to go to Riverside. But certainly, you can watch it online. We will have the information on the Axol website about how to connect with the hearing online. Okay, so we have some two lawsuits that are pending right now here in California. One of them has to do with female registrants. So the number of females on the registry is quite small, only about 135 of 106,000 registrants in California are females. But the Department of Corrections was doing something very wrong and stupid in that they came up with their own tool for assessing the risk level of the females on the registry. And basically, virtually every female on the registry was considered high risk. So what? That doesn't make sense to me. I hope it doesn't make sense to you either. But they were basically saying that. So we sued them. And by the way, in case you're wondering, what is an assessment tool? The one that's known best is the Static 99. Okay. So this was Static 99, by the way, everybody agrees that that is not something that can in fact be applied to females. And so it's not being used for females, but there wasn't a validated risk assessment tool. And so the Department of Corrections just came up with one on their own. And the result is most of the people, most of the women on the registry were considered high risk. And by the way, in California, if you're high risk and you're on parole, guess what? You can't live within half a mile of a school, a K-12 school. And in many jurisdictions, it's really hard to find a place to live that's not within half a mile of a school. So the good news is this case is almost finished. We have some bullet points. I don't have a settlement agreement yet, but one of the things that we're discussing is the possibility that they will basically remove the high-risk designation from every single female on the registry. So if they do that, and I do believe they will, I just can't tell you when, hopefully by early next year, then in fact, that will be a huge victory for women on the registry. So these are the types of lawsuits that we file, something that, you know, does affect as many people as possible. Another article that, lawsuit that we filed had to do with registrants on parole in general. And by the way, in California, we're talking about more than 7,000 people. So more than 7,000 people in California who were both on the registry and on parole were being required by the Department of Corrections to undergo treatment the entire time they're on parole. That in itself is problematic and challenging. You have to take the containment model requires, you know, two polygraph exams a year. It requires counseling sessions, group and also private. Many times it interferes with employment opportunities. So, but the worst thing about it, quite frankly, was in fact that when it came to being considered for early discharge, then people were being denied early discharge from parole because guess what? They were still in treatment. So it was like this catch 22. So that's why we filed the lawsuit. We were able to, it's funny because the case got settled quite early. The CDCR actually admitted they had done something they shouldn't have done. It was, you know, being lawyerly, I'll say inconsistent with state law, taking off my lawyer's hat of just like they were doing something illegal and they finally admitted it. So the solution was we agreed in settling the case that they would issue new regulations about treatment. And guess what? That was a little over a year ago. Unfortunately, they're not following their own regulations. So we're probably going to have to file a new lawsuit soon again about their lack of compliance with their own regulations. So unless you have a question about what that means, I'll just move on. Is there anybody here who's on parole and is still in treatment? And yes. By the way, By the way, in California, you can end up on parole for up to 20 years. Go ahead, sir.
So because of 3574, the Title 15 regulation of the California Code of Regs that provides the 1 year minimum. Let me say this right. So California Penal Code says a minimum of 1 year in sex offender management program. The new regulation that you helped get put on the books last year says that at the end of a year, they're supposed to do a containment team meeting and either issue a finding of good cause for retaining you in the meeting or discharge you from the program. Well, in California, like you said, they haven't done that with me. Well, they just recently did because I pushed on it through the administrative remedies process, and they did do that. But the out isn't there. There's no pathway for the 1 year to meet the 1 year minimum. In other words, the provider in Sacramento County does not have a one-year plan. They have a three-year plan, and for those a minimum three-year plan. So people with 10-year parole periods could end up in there for longer than for the entire duration of their parole period. I have a 3-year tail max on mine, but the point is still that guys have been in there for 7, 10 years in this treatment thing, and there's not even treatment being provided. It's just attending weekly meetings and sitting around, basically just checking in for an hour and a half and then leaving. So,
Eric, I am aware of that issue, and I'm not quite sure how to address it. But it's something that's on our playbook, or in our playbook, and a law, future lawsuit that we plan to file. So, thank you.
Awesome, cool. Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay. And somebody said it would seem that it should be a case time topic. They certify these programs. They actually certify the providers that case time does, right? But they don't necessarily certify the programs that the providers provide, and so that is an issue, and it's quite complicated. And by the way, folks, I mean, somebody said a long time ago, follow the money, and money is a huge issue in these cases, because in fact, so many people are making so much money from the treatment. The treatment providers are, but also the people at CDC are, because the greater number of people that are on parole, the bigger their budget. So they don't really want to let go of anybody, right? So then the treatment provider's like, oh, well, we can fix that. Right. And so then they basically tell so many people that you have to continue in treatment, and it's wrong. And so we're chipping away at it. We dearly are. Michael, did you have your hand up? Go ahead.
Yeah. I'm not expecting an answer, and I'm going to be really quick because it doesn't apply to 65 people. But those of us, for example, who are out of state, I'm on a 5-year parole. I'm in Winona, Minnesota, in the southeast corner, but I was paroled from California. I'm not on the registry in California anymore. Even though I'm on parole from there, I seem to exist only in the interstate compact. I'm not on the Megan's Law list in California. My 3-year mark will be coming up in April, and I have been discharged in Minnesota from all SOTP. So I think I'll probably be calling you or Jeff or Roger to say, how can I go about seeing if I can get an early discharge starting next April at the 3-year mark of my 5? When I'm discharged from out of state, don't seem to exist in state and only seem to be a cubbyhole in interstate. It's an interesting question. So ask more as a rhetorical question.
Yeah, well, thank you for bringing that up, Michael. Folks, he's specifically referring to the interstate compact. So in fact, if you are convicted in a state and then you're on parole in that state, but you want to move to another state, it's many times possible to do that, but you have to do it through the interstate compact process. I personally do not like that process. It is worse than that Rubik's Cube that I was talking about earlier, because it's so complicated. You basically are having to comply with laws in not one state, but 2 states. It's bad enough when you have to comply with the laws of one state, but when you have to do it in 2 states, and by the way, the receiving state and the sending state don't necessarily talk to each other. And so sometimes that there's often communication problems. So I'm just going to leave it at that. I mean, I understand many times that there's a good reason for you to enter into an interstate compact. Michael, I know your situation has to do with family. So it might be worth it, all that pain, but just know that it won't be one. Okay, so let's go ahead and talk about the tiered registry law, Ellie, and maybe you could start out that conversation. Tell us what the tiered registry law is, and how it's working, and anything else you'd like to say.
Okay, thanks, Janice. So I was just at a reentry conference about a week ago, and I met up with somebody after I gave a talk that included the tiered registry information, and his parole officer was saying, well, you know, maybe you can apply to get off the registration early, which is not true. In California, there are 3 tiers. There is tier 1, mostly for misdemeanors. There is tier 2, and there is tier 3. And tier 1 in California requires registration for 10 years. And the 10 years does not have to be consecutive. It can be the person did 5 years and then went back to prison for a chunk of time. The time the individual did in prison doesn't count. And then the person got out and started to register again. Even though now I know people do have to register in prison, apparently that's not counted because the person was incarcerated. Tier 2 registration is 20 years. And tier three is the lifetime registration. When somebody files a petition to be removed from the registry, what the petition that's available online, what the petition requires is a document called proof of current registration. It is not a copy of, you know, when the individual registers on his or her birthday or when he or she moved. It's proof of current registration. And the petition needs to be served or given to the prosecutor in the county where the individual registers. And if the offense was in a different county, it needs to be served to the original prosecutorial agency. And also the same goes with law enforcement. It goes to the law enforcement agency where the individual registers. And also if there was a different law enforcement involved in the arrest, it has to be served to that particular agency as well. Courts sometimes take a while to process this because the agency who where the individual registers is responsible for determining if that person has the requisite time, either 10 or 20 years. And if I fail to mention, tier three is the lifetime registration. And so right now there's no relief for those individuals. The police agency who handles the registration looks at the person's, probably their rap sheet, to determine if the individual has the requisite time. Some of you probably heard the story where I had a client who was tier one and he had bits and pieces of registration because he had gone to prison for a chunk of time, double digits for a kidnap for carjacking, but his subsequent criminal history didn't seem to matter when the court and the prosecutor determined if the individual was eligible for the relief. I believe Janice is with me on this. I always think that somebody who wants to do this needs a lawyer because sometimes going through the criminal justice system, even for a petition to terminate registration, sometimes can take left turns or right turns and sometimes is confusing. But it's a process. And I think for individuals on the registry, the very first step is to know what tier was assigned to the individual. And that information is obtained from the police agency where the individual registers. That's quite important because some people, you know, the person I talked to just last week had no idea what his tier assignment was. And the other issue is people with out-of-state convictions who moved to California. What the Department of Justice has to do is determine what the facts are of the out-of-state conviction, or not only the facts, but the statutory requirements of the out-of-state conviction. And even if it's a federal conviction and the person moves to California, the Department of Justice has to determine where it fits in. And sometimes this is also a confusing process, especially for people who may have a really old conviction in another state, and the Department of Justice has to determine where it fits in. Janice may have had some experience in challenging these, but I've had a few clients who are always confused as to why in one state it says one thing and they move to California and California seems to be a little bit different in terms of where it fits in the registry.
Yeah, so the one thing about the tiered registry law, it specifically says that if somebody's convicted out of state and now they currently live in California and they're petitioning, now live in California, that they can take Department of Justice up to 24 months. That's 2 years to decide whether or not to basically assign you to a tier. 2 years, right? I mean, that's just crazy. I'm working with somebody right now who was lucky enough. He was convicted in California. He moved out of state. Now he moved back to California. And actually, when he was in California earlier, he did get a tier assignment. So he's lucky in that regard. Also, people convicted in federal court, as Ellie said, but also military courts. So under the UCMJ, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, all of those situations, DOJ has up to 24 months to decide somebody's tier. I think that's ridiculous. And many things that the Department of Justice do, I think, is ridiculous, especially when it comes to people on the registry. But it is what it is. I want to emphasize something that Ellie said. She talked about having a client who basically had been in and out of prison. for quite some time, and finally, I guess, was eligible to petition for removal. I remember in one particular case too, a client, he, you know, rides a Harley. He looks like a biker because he's a biker. You know, he's got a rap sheet both before and after his sex offense for a variety of things. I'm trying to even remember if any of them were felonies. I can't remember. But the fact is, the judge granted his petition, and the judge was very specific and said, oh, well, he hasn't been convicted of another sex offense. And so the judge felt comfortable granting that petition. I had another man who was convicted of a white collar crime, and it had to do with embezzlement. He did give the money back. And, you know, I was even concerned for that man and whether or not a judge would grant his petition. And in fact, the court did grant the petition. So, I think one of the reasons to emphasize this is there's a large number of people who are probably eligible to petition for removal who are not petitioning, and we don't know why. So if any of you know anybody who might be eligible, you know, please tell them that there's law exists, and that refer them to Ellie, refer them to me, refer them to Jeff Stein, because we can help you figure out, you know, whether or not you're eligible. I mean, one of the steps is, in fact, getting that form 8050, the proof of current registration. You have that form has to be filed when the petition is filed. Okay, so it's not, so it makes a lot of sense. Go get the form right first to see if, in fact, you're eligible to petition. Well, that's step one. And then there's other things, like you make sure that you have the right number of years in registration. Make sure you have, you know, you're not on parole or probation. And that's, I was talking to another gentleman, and, you know, just this past week and stuff, who was recently convicted of another type of offense, and he's on parole for that other offense. And he's like, yeah, but my, you know, sex offense was more than 25 years ago, and he would otherwise be eligible to petition for removal. Well, I did the legal research and found out, well, that's unfortunate, because the fact he's on parole means that he's not eligible at this time. It doesn't mean he won't be eligible in the future, but he has to get off of parole. And the same is true of probation in order to file a petition. So there's so many, just to know, it's a lot of times, it's most of these petitions, by the way, are granted. I mean, a large, large percentage. I've gotten 137 petitions granted. I've only had two denied. So think about those odds. 137 granted, two of them denied. One of them that was denied was the case I told you about. He lived 10 years in Mexico. And so the judge said, well, that doesn't count. I didn't want to appeal that issue. But the other one I did appeal, and I won. And that day, the Superior Court judge forgot that it was in LA County. That if Superior Court judge forgot he was a judge and thought he was still a deputy district attorney, and he made a stupid decision. So I appealed it. And guess what? I got to do my victory lap going back to his courtroom, and he had to grant the petition because the appellate court told him so. But one of the great things about these petitions too are the two appellate decisions, People versus Ty and People versus Franco, both of which say the same thing, that if a DA objects to your petition, the DA has to prove that you pose a current risk. So in other words, the burden of proof is on the district attorney to prove that you are a current risk. And guess what? They cannot compel you to go get a psychological evaluation. They, and I don't know about your experience, Ellie, but the cases that I've had where the DA has objected to the petition, they said, well, look at the terrible thing that this person did. And guess what? That's not good enough. That doesn't fly. Christopher, you have your hand up. Thanks for waiting.
Sure. Here in Missouri, what I noticed with my son was two things. Number one, several years ago, our legislators changed the whole penal code. And when they did that, they increased his crime from what he actually pled guilty to in court and was convicted of. Now it's a higher offense under current state law, and there's no wiggle room around. He is judged according to what current law says, not what he pled guilty to and was charged with, convicted of. And then the second thing that I noticed is that I believe here in Missouri, in order to get off of the registry, you have to show, or one of the things you have to show is that you underwent some form of treat. However, for people like my son with severe disabilities, there is no treatment program within the community setting. So that wipes him off of any chance of being able to get off the registry as well.
You know, Christopher, I'm so sorry to hear about this and the situation, you know, and those challenges facing your son. I hope you all know about a U.S. Supreme Court case called Smith versus Doe. So the U.S. Supreme Court issued this decision back in 2003, and literally the court said that being on the registry is not punishment. So think about it. Being on the registry is not punishment. Think of all the challenges that you are are facing or have faced in the past, and the court is telling you, the court, the Supreme Court of the land is telling you that it's not punishment. Well, as far as I'm concerned, that's a bunch of nonsense too, right? And so, and because they ruled it's not punishment, then this is, goes to your situation, Christopher, then they, it basically gives government at every level, city governments, county governments, state governments, federal governments, gives all those governments the right to pass new laws and apply them retroactively, which is what happened to your son, okay, without it violating the ex post facto laws. This is, okay, so I'm going to swear now. Bullshit. It's just bullshit, okay? Because, I mean, I learned in law school 40 years ago in law school, right, that the thing is supposedly that before a person commits a crime, they think about what the punishment is going to be, all right? But how can that, but that can't be if, in fact, they go and change the rules on you after you've committed the crime, right? So it's not, I don't know your situation, your son's situation, if he admitted, you know, to committing a crime, you know, by entering into a plea agreement or something like that, but then he should have been given the penalty, the punishment for that crime, that punishment at the time he committed crime. And so for them to do what they're doing now is so wrong. It's just, it breaks my heart. It really does. And you know, as an attorney, as a human being, I'm just so offended by this. And quite frankly, the reason that I do the work that I'm doing, because the Constitution is being turned upside down and inside out when they pull things like this. And the court is just being intellectually dishonest. They really are. And part of their decision, by the way, is based upon nothing more than an article that was published in Psychology Today magazine. I mean, I hope that causes you all to stop and think. And like, what the hell? Why is the U.S. Supreme Court basing a decision on an article published in Psychology Today or any other magazine that's similar to that? I'm not just picking on Psychology Today, right? And there was one comment made by one person, and it was a marketing statement, by the way. It wasn't saying, oh, after I conducted research with 100,000 people, this is what I found out. It was just a marketing statement that he made. And by the way, he himself has backed down from that, that the person who made that statement, he's backed down from that and said, well, it was a marketing statement. He didn't even have statistics to prove what he said, which was basically, and what he specifically said was that people on the registry reoffend up to 80%. And by the way, no study has ever said that. No study has ever said that, which makes me want to ask you all to change your language about something. So sometimes people refer to recidivism rates, and sometimes people talk about reoffense rates. We will never win a recidivism rate argument, because recidivism rates includes any time somebody on the registry is returned to custody. It could be a flash incarceration for a week or 30 days, okay? But the reoffense rate is how often does somebody on the registry commit another sex offense? And you know what? In California, the reoffense rate for a person on parole is less than 1%. Less than 1%. I'm going to say it one more time. Less than 1% rate of reoffense for a person on parole convicted of a sex offense in California. And I think there's reoffense rates are similar in other states as well. We're lucky enough in California that our Department of Corrections actually put that in a document, their own report. They said this multiple years. I use it against them all the time when I file lawsuits against them, okay? Because they say, oh, it's frightening and high. If you've ever heard that phrase too. Well, that's a bunch of bullshit too. It's not frightening and high. There's a really extensive federal government study that was done by the Federal Department of Justice. They found that the reoffense rate was about 5.3% over a lifetime. 5.3%. So why is the government doing the things that they're doing? And you know what, folks? I have to say, sometimes our society just goes stupid. I mean, that's all I can think of. And also, we seem to have a proclivity to want to establish some group as a scapegoat group, right? And I have a personal attachment to this. I am not of Japanese descent, but guess what? My roommate in law school was of Japanese descent, and so were her parents, all right? Her parents were put in internment camps. The Supreme Court said, yes, internment camps are swell. You want to put people of Japanese American, of descent, even though they're U.S. citizens, in internment camps? You're going to tear them out of their homes and their farms and everything else? Yeah, that's just fine. You can do that, right? That case is Korematsu, by the way. Oh, you want a case further behind, you know, earlier than that? How about the case of Plessy versus Ferguson? Plessy versus Ferguson was overturned by Brown versus Board of Education. Most people don't know Plessy versus Ferguson, but Brown versus Board of Education basically said, Separate but equal education is not correct. Okay. So I'm only bringing this up. This is not to be, I'm not a law school professor. This is not to be meant even, about legal history, but you just need to know some basic facts. Okay. You need to focus on reoffense rates, and you need to talk about how that in fact, the Smith versus Doe says that, in fact, being on the registry is not punishment, which is a bunch of bullshit. Anthony, your hands up, sir.
Hi, Janice. Before I start, I just want to thank you for everything.
You're welcome.
So I'm eligible to file for my petition. I was eligible about 3 years ago. I do have the proof of registration, but 2 years ago, the officer at my at the site where I have to register informed me that that my registration is still showing up for a college that I was going to. I did what I had to do. I deregistered after my last semester, but that one of the officers about 3 years ago informed me that, it's still showing up.
Anthony, can I stop you for just a minute? Were you convicted of failing to register then?
No.
Okay. And the reason I ask that question is if, in fact, a person is convicted of failing to register, it does not make you ineligible to petition for removal, but it adds some time. So, but you weren't even convicted. So this is sounding strange. But please continue.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the reasons why I haven't filed my petition is because after the officer told me that, I'm still registered at the college. I'm just thinking it's going to be a roadblock, and I'm concerned that they're going to think that I was in compliance when I was, because I once I finished school, I deregistered. I still have proof that I deregistered, so I'm debating whether I should go back to the school and let them know, hey, there's a problem here, take care of that, and then.
No. Contact Ellie or me next week. Let's have a day off tomorrow, but contact us and we can help sort this out. I think one of the things that might be helpful is getting something called a life scan report, right? And life scan report in California is like your civilian rap sheet, civilian version of your rap sheet. And everybody goes, so many people go out and get it. I mean, I had to do one to become a Sunday school teacher. So cops do it. There's no stigma attached to getting a life scan report, but that certainly would be one place to go. But folks, and by the way, you're welcome. Failure to register. If you were convicted of a misdemeanor sex offense, they add 1 year. If you were convicted of a felony sex offense, they add 3 years. It does not mean you're ineligible to petition, but in fact, you'll just have to wait a little bit longer. So somebody, Roger, again, being so helpful here, put a link to the case of Smith versus Doe. Folks, we as an organization I shouldn't say the organization. Roger and I, as two human beings who think that the Supreme Court made a terrible mistake, have gone to the U.S. Supreme Court 3 years in a row, and we're going to go next year as well. You're welcome to come join us last year or this year in 2025. There was a conference. And we had about 50 people, I think, that were in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. It's organized. It's legal to do this. And I feel really good after I do it every single time. And we wrote this year, too. We wrote a letter. We got about 25 other organizations who signed the letter as well, letting them know that they need to overturn the case of Smith versus Doe. They've made mistakes before. I've told you about Korematsu. I told you about Plessy versus Ferguson. And there are other cases, too, where they've overturned themselves. In fact, this court seems to be really willing to overturn prior decisions. So maybe they'll overturn Smith versus Doe as well. So anyway, come join us in March of next year. March 5 is in fact the anniversary date of Smith versus Doe. How to get a life scan report. You contact me, Rafael, and anybody who wants to do it. And in fact, I will send you an application. It's relatively easy. You take it to any business that, in fact, processes live scan reports. They take your electronic fingerprints and they charge you about $50. Okay. The report is sent to you directly and nobody else sees it. So there's, again, no stigma attached to getting a live scan report these days.
And if I could add, Janice, make sure if you're in California, get the California live scan. Don't let them give you the federal rap sheet or live scan. I've seen federal live scans and they're just really hard to interpret. All they have is a bunch of numbers and they never seem to give you any information. But a live scan, it's L-I-V-E. scan, and it in California is the criminal history that one has with the Department of Justice. It even has arrests that did not result in a conviction. It has convictions. It has the results. Once in a while, there are errors. And so the last sheet of the life scan is usually a document to dispute any errors that may be on that life scan.
Yeah, thank you for that additional information, Ellie. So life scan reports are indeed important. Yes, I know that Roger and I, and I'm sure others will be joining, going to Washington, D.C. in March of next year. And we'll also have Lobby Day in March of next year. So we usually do Lobby Day in late March, and then the D.C. event is in early March. So plan to join us if you can. I think you will feel much better about yourself. One of the interesting things about the case of Smith versus Doe is that the current Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, John Roberts, he was the attorney who represented the state of Alaska in that case. John Roberts, the same John Roberts, was the attorney representing the state of Alaska. He was the one who said, and I'm paraphrasing here, that being on the registry is like having a membership in Price Club or Sam's Club or Costco. Really? You know what? I bet that turkey, and again, I'm bad-mouthing turkeys, I bet he's never been to a Costco or Price Club. I bet he's never had a membership in those things. And by the way, because there's a huge difference, right? If you have a Price Club membership, you can cancel the membership anytime you wish, right? So you can't cancel the requirement to register anytime you wish. So anyway, I shake my finger at him every year and tell him that he needs to basically fix his mistake. He's the boss of the Supreme Court, right? So he can tell these other people what to do. He should. So anyway, stay tuned. The case, by the way, about the SORNA regulations and Pacific Legal Foundation is is a case that could end up before the U.S. Supreme Court. I don't know if it will or it won't, but the fact is it might end up there. And remember, we're in very good hands there because Pacific Legal Foundation has taken at least 17 cases to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they've won 14 of them. Those are damn good odds. I'm glad they're our attorney. Okay, so moving on here, we've talked about all the major topics, and it's almost 12 o'clock. So why don't I do this? Why don't I just, again, remind you that the next Zoom meeting is on December 20th. All of our meetings are on Saturdays. We thank you for participating today and every Saturday that you show up. I thank Ellie and Roger and Monique, the board members here today. I appreciate all the positive things people had to say and talking about what you are thankful for. And I hope that you'll remember, you know, on Thanksgiving coming up really soon here, I hope that you'll remember that what you are indeed thankful for. I even think about the fact I'm thankful for having running water, and I'm thankful for having, you know, toilets that flush, and the fact that I have heat in my house. Sometimes I read about what's going on in third world countries, and those are huge luxuries to folks like that. And so to be thankful for those types of things. And thank you, Angela, for your that. Oh, somebody asked about the Missouri Halloween sign case. Yes, quick report here. Nothing's happened since last month. But the fact is we went to Missouri and argued that before the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. That was on September 16th. The Court of Appeals moves very slowly, and I predicted it's going to take at least 3 months to get a decision. So maybe before Christmas, but maybe not. I would imagine they go on holiday schedule in December as well. But the great news is that when it came to Halloween this year in 2025, guess what? The Missouri could not enforce its Halloween sign requirement. So yay. Ellie, I see the big smile on your face too. And Roger, thumbs up. Yeah, it was great. So, and Dave. So folks, this is the kind of work that we do. I'll just make one more plug here. If in fact you're able to donate to the organization, that would be truly appreciated. And donations of any amount, in fact, are appreciated. So Roger, Ellie, any last comments you want to make?
I just want to comment on someone who listens to these meetings after he's finished working. He filed a certificate of rehabilitation. This is a California remedy for people who went to state prison. And the Riverside prosecutor said he was ineligible. He wrote an excellent motion on his own when he went to the trial court. He filed an appeal. He won the appeal, and the Attorney General of California conceded conceded that he was eligible. The appellate court sent it back to the trial court, and the trial court granted his certificate of rehabilitation. So it is one more remedy that's available to people who have a registrable offense. And in this particular case, he did serve time in prison. He was ineligible for an expungement in California, but he got a certificate of rehabilitation granted, and he wanted to obtain it because he wants a contractor's license, and he's on that path to getting his contractor's license. So he did an excellent job on his own, had an excellent appellate attorney, and there you go.
Good. Thank you for sharing the good news with us, Ellie. Roger, how about you?
One thing that comforts me is I think African Americans, gays, Native Americans, all people groups who wanted civil rights, they had to look at the long term. So I just encourage everyone. I know it's frustrating. You know, there are setbacks, and it seems like there's a never-ending desire for politicians to get points by, you know, trying to put more restrictions on us. But we have come a long way, and we're getting more and more united nationwide with other groups. We've had a tremendous amount of success. And so just, I know focusing on gratitude, I think, is a big part of it, is what have we won? And if we can do that, we can stick it out for the long term.
Thank you for those words of encouragement, Roger. Thank you, everybody. Stay safe and have a very happy Thanksgiving. Take care. Bye-bye.